60 years ago today, the United States began the operation that came to be known as the Berlin Airlift. World War II had ended, Berlin was divided, and Russia blockaded West Berliners in hopes of taking over the city. Andrei Cherny is the author of a new history of the operation called The Candy Bombers, The Untold Story of the Berlin Airlift and America's Finest Hour.
West Berlin after World War II was a destroyed, destitute city. Three-quarters of the housing was uninhabitable. Packs of wolves roamed the streets. People had been surviving on rations that were below starvation levels for about 4 years.
The U.S. decided it would not let the Russians crush West Berlin. They started to launch planes carrying food. Here's a report from the era by Edward R. Murrow.
A city the size of Philadelphia was supplied for a year completely by air. Cargo planes, usually C-54s, touched down at Tempelhof Aerodrome every 3 minutes.
The planes brought staples like coal and flour.
They looked at that flour and back at you like your angels from heaven. We had freedom, we had flour. They needed both.
This is Hal Halverson. He's now 87 years old. 60 years ago, as a young Army pilot, Halverson decided to break the rules of the airlift. While he was on the ground in West Berlin, he gave some German kids two sticks of gum.
Broken in half, four pieces. And the kids with a half a stick carefully tore off the outer wrapper in strips and passed it around. And the kids with a piece of paper put it up to their nose. And just the aroma, they smelled it.
Halverson decided he had to do more, so he promised the kids he'd drop candy from his airplane the next day.
The children at the fence in Berlin, when I told them that I would make a drop to them, they said, well, how are we going to know your airplane? And I said, well, I'll wiggle the wings. I will make the wings go back and forth, and you'll know that that is the signal that I've got the stuff, and just watch that airplane.
German kids came to know Halverson as Uncle Wiggly Wings, the anonymous pilot whose plane dropped candy, author Andre Cherny.
It was just a few handkerchief parachutes of chocolate and gum, candy, and he did it once, and about 20 kids got some candy, and the next day about 100 kids were there, and then 1,000.
Of course, I kept this thing a secret as long as I could, and a German newspaper guy got wind of it in Berlin and got a picture of my airplane with the tail number on it and parachutes. And
his secret was out, and he was revealed as the person who was doing this.
That blew my cover, and I got chewed out and almost court-martialed.
But instead of a court-martial, other pilots started following Halverson's lead. Eventually, U.S. candy companies donated tons of chocolate.
You have to remember, these were kids 5, 6, 7, 8 years old who had never tasted a piece of candy before, never tasted a piece of chocolate. And their only experience with America at this age was the country that had bombed them during World War II, in many cases killed many of their relatives, and then occupied them in a rather harsh occupation in the years afterwards. And suddenly here was, falling from the heavens, literally, this Hershey bar, this Wrigley gum.
You interviewed some Germans who received candy as children. 60 years later, how do they describe those moments?
It was, for me, in the entire research of this book, which took many years, one of the most moving parts, to walk down the street of Berlin with Colonel Halverson and to have people come up to him with tears in their eyes, people in their 60s and 70s, some of whom are still carrying around that handkerchief that they caught 60 years ago, and talk to him about how that transformed their lives.
Cherny calls the Berlin Airlift America's Finest Hour.
What the people involved in the Berlin Airlift, from the President of the United States and his generals down to the lowliest pilot and operator, came to understand was how America should operate at the summit of world power. We discovered that America has a special role to play, one that combines our military force as well as our moral power.
The pilot, Hal Halverson, is still flying. This week, he's in Berlin, marking the 60th anniversary of the airlift with a flight along his old route. His celebrity has faded in the U.S., but author Andre Cherny says in Germany, Halverson is still treated like a national hero.
One thing the internet has done in China, it's freed many young writers to post their literary efforts online. Under the Communist Party, authors had to penetrate a maze of loyal party members to get a book published. In this final in our series about the internet's impact on Chinese arts and culture, NPR's Laura Seidel talks about novels.
Back in the days when Mao Zedong was still running China, literature was supposed to be in the service of workers, peasants, and soldiers. But there was underground literature that people passed around in bound notebooks.
It was very dangerous to copy them and to pass them around. You could get in trouble if you got caught with them.
That's Princeton University East Asian Studies professor Perry Link. If you're thinking that those notebooks were filled with the writings of a Chinese Solzhenitsyn criticizing the Communist Party, you would be wrong.
They were almost all this kind of entertainment fiction, triangular love stories and detective stories and things like that.
People wanted that kind of pulp fiction, but what made it through the government censors and into bookstores was often dry and boring and always had to have a message about the improvement of communist society. But now writer Fu Tian, that's her pen name, is not thinking about how to make a better China. The pale afternoon sun filters through a dusty window in her Shanghai apartment. It lights up her mischievous face as she types. All she wants is to entertain her readers. Fu, whose real name is Zhang Shuyu, writes historical fiction. Her latest book is filled with romance and palace intrigue.
The story is based on Wu Zetian, the only female emperor in Chinese history. In my book, there is a little girl who is like one of the daughters of the female emperor. In real history, the princess did not succeed in getting power, but in this novel, she does.
Here's a short segment from the beginning of her book.
Although the carriage was moving smoothly, Su Cui felt restless inside. It was the first time she had ever left her hometown. She had spent the previous 8 years of her life in a small town living with her aunt and uncle. The couple had shown her a picture of her father, saying that he was a well-known warrior. They didn't tell her anything about her mother. But a few days ago, a visitor came in a hurry and said that her mother wanted her to go to the capital city.
Fu has been writing novels exclusively for the internet for over a year. She now has thousands of loyal readers. They come to find her stories on a website called Chidian. It's so successful that 70 people now work at its offices.
Wei.
Sitting in rows and rows of cubicles, editors sort through the thousands of submissions posted on the site every month. They're trying to figure out what's going to be popular and move it up to the front page. Fu Tian is so popular, she gets health benefits and a base salary from Chidian. Wu Wenhui, one of the site's founders, says Chidian gets about 200 million page views a day and is one of China's most popular literary sites. He says Fu Tian quickly drew the attention of readers and editors because she is funny and fun. Her fans must pay 2 cents to read each new installment of her novels, and Fu gets a cut. Manager Wu admits this model doesn't always lead to the most literary fiction. He says on the internet, writing is focused on plot, writers and chapters on cliffhangers to keep readers' attention, and there isn't much focus on grammar and style. Joe Lusby, the general manager of Penguin Books in China, thinks online lit is in its infancy and is likely to get better as it matures.
I think it's very young. I think the writers themselves are extremely young. This is young people writing for young people.
And there is some good news for those people who like actual books made of paper. Fu Tian and her internet colleagues still want to see their writing in print, and publishers are looking to the internet to find young talent. I take a visit with Fu to Shanghai City of Books. It takes up 6 stories of a high-rise downtown.
So where is your favorite section of the bookstore?
Let me look for it.
Fu Tian has been coming here since she was a teenager. As she strolls through the aisles, the books that catch her eye are often by other internet writers.
The Ghost Blows Out the Light. That used to be the greatest hit on Shidan website, and it's being made into a movie.
Do you hope that happens to you, that it gets made into a movie?
Of course.
Fu's very excited that she will have a real live paper book you can buy in a bookstore coming out this fall. While she's elated by the freedom and the opportunity that the internet is bringing to her and other young Chinese writers, she admits there are limits.
We have greater freedom than writers who work in the traditional publishing system, but it is still not like you can write about anything.
Like, meaning what? Not anything.
You need to do positive things, if we can put it this way.
Fu cannot write about political topics such as Taiwan or Tibet. She and other young writers on the internet can be as entertaining as they want with their cliffhangers, romances, and historical fantasies. They just can't write about anything too serious or politically sensitive. For them, the internet is the great entertainment highway.
George Washington's copy of the Constitution.
The first map with the word America on it.
And the 15th century Gutenberg Bible, the first book printed using movable type.
Just some of the 138 million items at the Library of Congress, the largest library in the world, located right behind the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. On the second floor, under a dome of the main building, there's a new exhibit, 20 climate-controlled bookcases, each 10 feet tall, standing in an open circle.
I really just think of this as Jefferson's world. We're just surrounded by Jefferson's world here.
That's Mark Diminution, the chief of rare books and special collections at the Library of Congress. For the past decade, he and his staff have been trying to recreate the library Thomas Jefferson kept at his Monticello home.
These are the books that he owned and worked with to write the Declaration of Independence. These are the books that he consulted and obtained in order to be a better diplomat in France. This is the historian who chronicled the early histories of Virginia, the planter, the gardener, the architect, the musician, the gourmand, the vintner.
Which explains why you can find Common Sense by Thomas Paine, Plato's Republic, and Adamo Fabroni's Del Arte di Fare il Vino, The Art of Making Wine, also among the shelves. And yes, Jefferson did read Italian. He also read French, Latin, and Spanish. He loved his books.
It's 6,487 volumes, which represents almost 5,000 titles. This was accumulated over the span of about 50 years.
Why did he sell his library?
He was mortified that with the destruction of the Capitol and during the War of 1812, when the Capitol was burned by the British, with it burned the Congressional Library. And he felt it extremely important that to govern in an enlightened world, in a world of reason, that governors required access to thought, philosophy, reason, law. It's very much a notion of the Enlightenment that any problem can be solved if one goes about in a determined study to arrive at the best solution. So he offers to sell his collection to the American people, at that time the largest collection held in private hands in North America. His gesture was that he was willing to sell it at whatever price Congress would pay.
$24,000 later, the equivalent of $334,000 today, Congress had a new library. A bargain, says Mark Diminution. However, it became a huge loss in 1851 when another fire destroyed two-thirds of Jefferson's collection. The match wasn't lit by the British that time. It was a faulty chimney flue. To recreate Jefferson's library, Diminution and his staff first combed through their own shelves at the Library of Congress. They found a couple thousand books. Then the hunt for replacements took them to the antiquarian book market, where they bought a couple thousand more. These books are treasures, often irreplaceable, so they're protected behind glass. But this being the information age, you can virtually browse through many of them, much as you would in a regular library.
So we're standing here at the kiosk that has books in front of us on imagination.
Through the wonders of technology, Diminution glides his fingers across a tabletop touchscreen. With a tap, he selects a book from the shelf. It's Machiavelli's The Prince.
You're looking at the title page of the book in Italian. If we click on View This Book, I can actually turn the pages with my finger on the actual display screen. So we're actually paging through this book digitally. Or, if you'd like, we can actually translate it. So there it says, Chapter 2, Concerning Hereditary Principalities.
Another book, part of a two-volume set by John Quincy Adams, reveals an inscription when Diminution opens the screen. John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, January 1st, 1812. It was a gift from the second president to the third, in the years when the two former friends were trying to patch up their relationship. There are gems like this throughout the collection, a collection that, as yet, is incomplete. According to Jefferson's records, Diminution and his team still have to find 299 books and pamphlets.
There's an Italian pamphlet on the pomegranate tree that I suspect is going to vex us for the rest of this project. There are a couple of things like that.
Where would you go to find such a thing?
Apparently Italy, but we haven't been too lucky so far.
So, if any of you happen to have that pamphlet or a 1789 copy of The Act for Repealing the Duties on Tobacco and Snuff, well, Mark Diminution would like to make you an offer. In the meantime, you can visit Thomas Jefferson's books at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
I'm Netta Ulibi. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, Andrew Sean Greer reads from his acclaimed new novel, The Story of a Marriage. It's about a young woman in the early 1950s. She's a former war worker, a new mother, African-American, and living in a slowly desegregating San Francisco neighborhood when she finds herself faced with an unusual proposition.
Now, what would you do if you had all the money you needed? I had no answer to that. It was a thoughtless question to ask a poor woman with a sick son, something only a rich man would ask, like wondering aloud to a freshly broken-hearted girl, what if it turns out he loved you after all? It was something I had never allowed myself to think about. What would I have done? I'd have moved my family away from a house like that, with glaring neighbors and stains in the basement walls from the ocean creeping in, with crickets sifting in out of the door sills with the sand, to Egypt, to Mali, to some fantasy destination I only knew from books. My God, I'd have flown to Mars with Holland and Sunny and never come back. That was the only answer I could think of. A woman like me, I couldn't afford to name my real desires. I couldn't even afford to know them.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. June is the month when lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans celebrate their community with gay pride gatherings across the country. We wanted to figure out if there was a reading list of good books about that community. So we have some ideas for you. Joining us now is Laureen Roy of the American Library Association. She's our frequent guest to talk about books. Welcome back, Laureen.
Oh, it's good to be back, Michelle.
So, Laureen, how did you come up with your list this month?
Well, I went to my colleagues in the American Library Association and emailed actually the chairperson for the Gay, Lesbian, Transgender Roundtable and just said, you know, tell me about some recent books. And I'm especially interested in their book awards. These are called the Stonewall Book Awards, the oldest book award of its kind, established in 1971. And they're given out to the best written books on LGBTQ themes.
Let's talk first about some novels that you recommend. I think there are two.
One of my favorites is a novel called Beau Grip, written by Canadian Evan Coyote. And if you like stories about small-town life, if you like stories about rural areas and stories about families, I think this is a really good read. I would recommend it for junior high school and up to adults.
Okay. And what about The Indian Clerk?
The Indian Clerk, it is a fictional book, but really includes, it's that sort of that trend of novels that include historically factual people. That is, you'll find references to Bertrand Russell, D.H. Lawrence. It's a mix of the history of mathematics, the history of English professional education. It's a hefty tome. We're talking almost 500 pages with a good resource list at the back. So a novel based on fact with a lot of real characters. And one of my favorite features of this book is at the end, the author describes what he used that was fictional and how he created those stories and what was fact. A lot about English dons, dinner parties, and the academic traditions of British education.
And what age group do you think this would be suitable for?
I think you're talking college age. This looks and reads like an academic book, and there are a lot of mathematical formulas in it that I looked at briefly and then moved on. So, but if you like history of Britain, history between the wars, I think you would enjoy that book.
You had a whole range of memoirs, I understand.
Oh, yes, and I think the favorite is actually a winner, a recent winner of the Nonfiction Stonewall Book Award, and this is Dog Years. And it's a memoir written by Mark Doty, who's an author, a poet, educator. But it's about dogs, but also about love and the decline of the physical, human decline, canine decline. Mark talks about two dogs in particular, Arden and Beau. And some of the segments in it are very touching. There are chapters that are interspersed with his kind of realm of poetry, ties in recent events such as the events related to 9/11. But if you love dogs and you're missing anyone in your life, or if you've just fallen in love, I think this is a great read.
This is a good time to clarify. What kinds of books are available for the Stonewall Awards? Does the Stonewall Books Awards, does it have to be by an LGBT writer? Does it have to have an LGBT theme? What kinds of books are included?
Well, we're looking at books that have the themes. And in this case, these are books that are just very well written. These are books that would appeal to any audience. So in the case, for example, of Bow Grip, you're not really looking at explicit depiction of relationships. You're looking at the intricate nature of family. The same thing with Dog Years. It's a book that would appeal to anyone, but the awards are given for quality writing.
Now, I think I feel comfortable in saying that people of color sometimes feel invisible within the LGBT experience, or sometimes feel invisible in sort of public discussions of LGBT issues. Are there any books that you found that speak to that part of the experience?
Well, I think you could look at the nonfiction book Transparent: Love, Family, and Living with the Transgender Teenagers, because in this case, journalist Chris Beam, who moved to L.A. and started to volunteer at a school for gay and transgender kids, features four of the students, including students of color. My favorite character is a young man named Foxajazzle, and he's just a very confident young person, and even tells Chris when she first meets him, you know, in the initial telephone conversation, "I'm going to be a major star, I'd say, within 3 years, so if you want a shot at writing my biography, you better get with it now." So I like the energy of the young people, but there's street talk, there's the talk of everyday high school students, and also their own challenges.
Now, most of the books on your list are relatively new. Are there any classics that we should be aware of?
I went to the recent Stonewall Awards in particular because they receive their recognition each year at the annual American Library Association conference. I think some of the characters in these books could also be explored in past writing. For example, we do have autobiography, these journals of Leo Lerman, and that is really a celebrity sort of autobiography with inserts of diary entries and letters. And I think you could take some of the individuals that he meets and trace their histories through other writings. For example, there are segments about Truman Capote. Similarly, with the new book about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, you can also explore those authors and other works. And I think those would trace you back to some classic titles.
Now, the American Library Association is always concerned about books being banned. Have any of the books that you think are of quality or have been recognized as books of quality about the LGBT experience been banned?
The most banned book in the U.S. right now is a children's book called And Tango Makes Three. And in that story, which is a factual story, two male penguins raise a little chick. And in that case, I think the motivation that some might have toward not recommending that book may be based on the sexuality, implied sexuality of the characters in that picture book.
Is that a good book, though?
It is a great book. I've met the authors, and it's a great read, and it's a lovely story. And the little chick finds a loving and happy home, and it's based on reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, is the American Library Association marking Gay Pride Month, and if so, how?
Well, ALA has its annual conference at the end of June, early July, and we mark our connections with the LGBT community in several ways. One is there is an award ceremony for this year's Stonewall winners. There are events that the GLBT Roundtable sponsors. ALA draws 20 to 24,000 professionals in our field and colleagues and supporters, and there's something for everyone at conference.
Lorene Roy of the American Library Association. She joined us today from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. And if you couldn't keep track of all the titles that Lorene mentioned, do not despair. We will have a list of all those books on our website, as well as previous titles recommended by Lorene, at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Lorene Roy, thanks again.
Oh, you're welcome, Michelle.
Imagine that your significant other has been replaced by a fake, a clone, a doppelganger, and you don't know why. You don't call her out on it, you just kind of play along, all the while trying desperately to crack what you believe is a global conspiracy responsible for her disappearance. Questions begin to mount. Who is the double? Why is she here? Why does she have a dog? Who's good, who's bad, and who's crazy? The questions lead the protagonist on a search for truth, or his version of the truth. From New York to Buenos Aires to Patagonia, this is the premise of Rivka Galchen's debut novel, Atmospheric Disturbances. Galchen's book has been hailed as a twisting, erudite mystery driven by scientific and psychological intrigue. Rivka Galchen joins me now in the studio. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Something is wrong. This man's wife has gone missing. Her name is Rima. Explain to us a little more about who this character is. Leo Liebenstein is his name, and what is his plight?
You know, this woman comes home who isn't his wife, who he just has a conviction. He can't quite articulate it, but he knows, I don't know, this isn't her. And he has to come up. He begins searching for his wife, who, despite this other woman in the home, you know, his wife is gone. And in the process of searching, he forms some strange alliances. He ends up forming an alliance with one of his patients who's quite delusional, and he sort of starts thinking that maybe his patient isn't so delusional. So he starts sort of casting about for a possible explanation and route towards his missing wife.
He, in essence, he becomes part of he buys into this false reality that he's trying to deconstruct for his patient.
Yes, exactly. Like, in the process of sort of stepping into that reality where he sort of thinks he's got one foot in the kind of consensus idea of what's going on and one foot in his patient's reality to help manage him, he starts thinking, well, this foot that I thought was grounded in the more likely reality has its own strange things going on. And it may be like when I'm in this other space, which is sort of was introduced to me by my patient, like there are explanations for what's going on that make a lot more sense, or that at the very least are less painful than the explanations presented to me in this reality I started out in.
Now, this book is highly personal for you in a lot of ways. Zvi Galchen, that name that you gave to a very prominent character in the story is the name of your late father.
Right, exactly. You know, here, obviously, for everyone, you know, if you lose your father, you know, it's extremely painful, but it's not something that I would want to talk about directly because it both seems personal and like you can never represent it well, mm-hmm. and it just seems odd. So instead of sort of like talking about what that particular sad feeling might be like or what my real dad might be like, instead I sort of like transformed that energy and interest in a person into the creation of this other world inside the book where they make kind of like a mock hero out of him, and it's just sort of like a pleasure. It's just the kind of thing that gets you up every day to work on it because it amuses you.
The story is so much about meshing realities or versions of truth. It's also about a marriage or a communion between science or hard sciences and the softer social sciences. These are things that are so clearly embodied in you, in your personal history, right? Talk a little bit about how you approach this. You yourself, we should point out, are a doctor.
Yeah.
I am a doctor.
That's what my mom tells all her friends, and it's true. For whatever reason, most of the first things that seemed beautiful to me or that I projected emotional value onto were scientific things. Like, even when I was little, like the proof that the square root of 2 was irrational was to me like something so sort of succinct and elegant that it's easy to put emotional value on that may or may not belong. Like emotional value, like, oh, this seems to suggest the world has an order. This seems to suggest the world has an interesting and beautiful story to tell us. That may or may not be true, but those were the first places my emotions went rather than to stories or books. And in order to like successfully project your emotion onto it and get a sense of authority, like I like that scientific language lets us do that. Like it makes us feel like the emotion we have associated with it is more authentic than, you know, watching a Kleenex commercial. But in fact, we're still so much in control of what that emotion is going to be.
There is a lot of science in the book. The main character is a psychologist, and he's dealing with this supposed consortium of meteorologists. Is the science real, or is this part of the fiction?
Right. Well, the actual scientific quotations almost all come from my father's actual papers, and almost all of the sort of scientific facts in there happen to be real facts. And although the character Leo has a way of kind of grossly misappropriating any factual information to his own emotional ends, they still are true things out there in the world.
Which is such a human thing, really.
Yeah.
And talk about the doppelganger effect.
Leo ends up coining this term, stealing it from the Doppler effect, which is sort of the effect that makes things appear to go, say, a sound, like when a car passes us, the sound will appear to change in pitch up and down as it gets closer and further, because the, you know, waves are coming to us faster because it's moving relative to us.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, emotionally, this is relevant to the narrative situation because, you know, love and a relationship is inevitably dynamic and both people are changing and moving, and it doesn't get him very far, but it's sort of a beautiful thing that he designs in order not to move forward. And I find that interesting, the way that sometimes in the process of not looking, we have to construct something pretty elaborate in order to obscure our vision. And that thing that is constructed can take on its own beauty, mm-hmm. I think.
Why did you choose to write this in the voice of an older man? I mean, you're a doctor, you're a psychiatrist. You have that background that clearly informed how you evolved this character. But you could have made a choice about gender or age. Why did that fit for you?
Right. Well, you know, I think I've always been incredibly jealous of boys or men for this one particular thing, which is that I don't know if it's just the particular men that I've known in my life, but they sort of, you know, go around saying what they say, thinking what they think, whether it's politics, whether it's sports, whether it's movies. They say it with so much authority. So I find that stance both incredibly appealing and yet utterly absurd, because there is obviously on some level I sort of think, well, how can you go around being confident like that? Shouldn't you entertain more doubt? And so I think in some weird way I just sort of thought, like, well, I want to occupy that voice of confidence and authority while at the same time I want to be sympathetic to it, because I think, you know, there's an emotional reason to strut around so confidently. Like, there must be a reason to construct that kind of facade around your thoughts, and I want to be sympathetic to that also. So it was just fun.
So much of about this book is Leo's failure to see his wife, even though she's all the while desperately trying to make him believe that she is indeed the woman that he fell in love with. Has this changed how you look at your own marriage? You've been married for a while now.
For 7 years.
And someone might read this book and say, oh, whoever wrote this is kind of a cynic about whether or not marriage can actually sustain.
I know. How terrifying. But I mean, I guess I sort of think marriages can't sustain if someone sort of is rigid and like endlessly devoted to a person who doesn't exist anymore, which is so-and-so 7 years ago. Like, that person is just as gone as someone who has died. And I think that, I don't know, it's unclear whether Leo himself gets there. He sort of speculates towards that space of reimagining what it would be like not to be with the woman he married, but to be with the woman in his house now. And that's always the question, like, can this, you know, can people fall in love again and again? Because it seems to me, although I'm not like the oldest person in the world, I'm not that young either, it seems to me those
You're
are the only
young.
It seems to me those are the only relationships that work when for some reason you can find new reasons to be in love.
The book is called Atmospheric Disturbances. The author is Rivka Galchen. We thank you for coming into the studio. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.